You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Patrick.
Tracy.
So, I've been thinking about cover art, right? Okay. Do you have like
Galen Dara?
You have excellent Galen Dara cover art. 10 out of 10, no notes. Yeah. So that is pretty fantastic. Do you have any books that you remember doing a double take and being like, I need to investigate this book just purely on like the theory of cover art being like, make them want to look? Do you have any memories of
that? As you know, I'm slightly older than the average person. And I love the old style, old school kind of fantasy art covers. Mm-hmm. Those always. So I cannot remember his name, unfortunately, and he has passed on. Mm-hmm. But there was one guy who for a little while like did a ton of the cover art for fantasy novels for Tor. Mm-hmm. He did all the Wheel of Times. He did all of the Ellie Modisette Jr. books. He was doing like the Kate Baker books. He was doing all of those at one point. So I'm just going to throw all of those in because I just love when someone does gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous book covers.
I think one of the reasons I have a particular appreciation for cover art is that some of the books that I love most deeply had, at least in the editions I encountered them in, deeply terrible cover art. Mm. Like, I really had to talk myself. They were usually books that came to me by recommendation of someone else. And I really had to talk myself into being like, are you sure? Because this is like, whoa. Like, I have copies from used bookstores and whatnot of some of those editions of those books. And when I lend them out to people, they give me that certain kind of like stink face. And I have to be like, no. I promise it's so much better than the cover. And all of this is winding up to a couple of months ago when I was looking at opportunities for having people come on. Oftentimes when folks reach out to me about authors and opportunities and whatnot, they have a pitch, they describe the book, and often the description of the book is the most compelling thing for me. I was certainly deeply compelled by the description of the book in question here. But then I got to the cover art and I like smashed reply so hard, which is at least 50% of, to put aside the concept of the story itself, why we're talking to Frances White about the Bone Door today. So Frances, welcome aboard.
Thank you. No, that's totally valid. I would pick it up based on the cover art as well.
It looks as if you've had the same cover artist or designer for your debut, The Voyage of the Damned. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's the same designer. Her name's Nina Elsteed, and she's incredible.
Oh, yeah. So, all right. So, I mean, picture worth 1,000 words, et cetera, but you've written more than just 1,000 words here in The Bone Door. So catch folks up to the teaser that I got.
So The Bone Door is, I call it, a fantasy horror escape room novel where a 11-year-old boy called Hop wakes up in a labyrinth with no memory of who he is or what he's doing there. And in order to escape, he has to travel through a series of rooms, which all lead to mysterious and different realms. And he has to solve impossible tasks in each room in order to open the door to the next room and escape out of the bone door, ultimately, hopefully.
So one of the things that I love about this concept, and I have a kind of personal agenda here because it goes back to some of my own writing, is that you have such deliberately young characters in your story, and that this is not a story that is like, and by the way, this is a middle grade book, not by any stretch of the imagination. And so I would love to have you kind of walk us through the desire to tell this very dark and this very intense and challenging story from the experience of these very young protagonists.
Yeah, I feel like it was a few reasons that all came together. First of all, I've always loved that sort of genre of like darker fantasy that has, or darker sci-fi that has main characters that are children. Like, I call it like the kids on bikes sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Like we're all, let's go see the dead body.
Yeah, like It and like Stranger Things, that sort of vibe, like the friendship overall vibe. But I think when I was writing, when I first came up with the story, I came up just with the concept of someone waking up in a creepy labyrinth and no idea where they were. And I kind of like came up with the main character by thinking, who is like the most interesting character to put in that situation that you kind of wouldn't expect, that's a bit different? And that's why I decided to go with the really innocent, naive, hopeful young child, because there's something about the darkness and horribleness of this situation compared to like the idealism and like the naivety of the main character that I really wanted to play off against each other. First of all, in a humorous way, but then also in quite a serious darkness versus light way. And I think, especially in horror, like one of the things you want to do is take away the agency or the power of the main character, because that's the scariest thing. And usually you have to like cut the phone lines or like get them kidnapped. But when it's like a young child who they basically have not much power anyway, it's you're already in that situation, so it's just heightening everything. So yeah, I'm a little bit evil, I think that's why.
Oh, so that's it.
That's the real reason. All the rest is my professional answer.
Patrick, your eyes get so big when Francis said kids on bikes as a genre. I love that reaction.
It just reminded me because Stand By Me, when the movie
yes
came, I remember one of my best friends, you know, like I lived here and he lived way over here kind of thing. And I remember we would walk from my house to his house, and there was a group of us. And we like walked up to the railroad and we took the railroad across town, like just walking on the tracks. Wow. Because it cut through the town and it kind of was a shortcut for us. But that
it's
was
not like you're going to get lost.
It was all because of Stand By Me, because like those kids, they were like, oh yeah, we just walk on the railroad tracks. And we're like, hey, we should do that. And what we didn't realize, number one, we got like busted because railroad tracks are stupid, filthy, dirty. And so by the time we got to his house, our shoes were just black on the bottom, and then we're trekking it everywhere we go. So that's kind of what reminded me of that. It's just like that's been around for so long, that kind of trope of like the kids like riding their bikes and going somewhere. And like, yeah, we did that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such like a childhood sort of nostalgic feeling to it.
Yeah.
Is that something from your own experience as well, Francis?
I sadly never walked along railway tracks as a child. I don't know if I wouldn't be able to do. They're so dangerous. Like, I'm surprised you never got almost plowed down by a train.
I think it was because it was Fresno. It was probably a freight line, and I don't think there was a lot of freight trains at the time going through there. But
yeah, I definitely had like my little crew. We did make little go-karts together. Oh. And like went around the street, so that's kind of my version of that.
Francis, you were in a gang.
Yeah, totally.
Semi-permanent marker tattoos going on in the backs of the hands over here.
I love that, because where I grew up was basically mainly countryside and like cows. So
right, yeah.
Tough gang, yeah.
Yeah, the cows saw you coming, they're like, oh no. Francis and her crew. Give them a wide berth. It's amazing. But, you know, I think the kids on – I'm going to keep leaning into the kids on bikes thing here, because I think – I don't know. It's fired up something in my brain. What I love about the kids on bikes, especially relative to you talking about horror, being about you do something to disrupt or to take away the agency of the characters, the whole kids on bike phenomenon is it's like – as a kid, there are only so many ways you're allowed autonomy and freedom. And, you know, there's like the joke of Gen X is like the feral hose water generation that is now forgotten. And then everybody else since then has been helicoptered or hypermanaged in some degree. Or, you know, in the case of, I guess, Gen Alpha, I guess the theory going with Gen Alpha is we've just abandoned them all into the iPad verse and they will be raised by our digital overlords. But what I think is interesting there is like the kids on bikes phenomenon sort of runs exactly counter to the horror logic of we have to take away your agency, because kids do that because they want their agency, right? And so it's kind of this really cool natural friction.
Yeah, that's part of the tension of it. I wanted to have the friendship. Well, like, we can do anything with the power of friendship. The power of friendship is mentioned several times in the book alongside, like, the most horrifying, like, you cannot beat this with the power of friendship. Yeah. Creatures, yeah. Or
I'm gonna
story.
Do some Care Bear shit here.
Yeah. Which, yeah, it was an interesting thing to play with, and also, like, very a challenge as a writer, because I was like, well, I've set this up and now I have to actually write the story and make it work.
Yeah.
Oh dear, have I screwed them too badly?
Yeah, I've set the odds too high or too low.
yeah. Oh Lord. And I think that the labyrinth as well, I mean, that there's obviously, like, there's winks and nudges there. There's, like, what if a little bit of Maze Runner, but, like, what if also, like, Jim Henson's Labyrinth? And, like, there's so many different ways that can be kind of played with. I imagine, I shall not make too many assumptions about your age, but I suspect that you might have a certain kind of relationship to Rick Riordan's work, you know, in your own childhood. No?
I've actually never read it or watched it or anything.
Oh, okay. So this is a marvelous discovery for me. Not because I have no beef with Rick Riordan, to be totally clear here. But, like, so I teach at a high school, and all of the – he's making the note now to put in the sound. I teach at a weird high school for gifted kids. So anyway, the weird high school for gifted kids where I teach, like, they have all been, like, raised by Rick Riordan. Like from conception, it seems like. And so the whole idea of, like, you say labyrinth to them and they're going, like, Minotaur, and they're thinking Theseus and the whole deal. So you've got a lot of, like, mythological and sort of referential things to play with here. And I'm kind of curious about to what extent you said, like, yeah, I'm going to do all those things. Or you said, no, I really don't want to touch on a lot of that stuff. Like, what was the calculus of that for you?
I honestly think my main inspiration for setting it in a labyrinth came from the fact that I read Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, like, a bit before, which is set in a very dreamlike, strange labyrinth. And I think I like the strangeness and knowableness of it. So although they're set this task and they've got to go through these doors, I still wanted the labyrinth to be, like, a huge mystery in itself. And I said I wasn't writing a mystery of this book, because my last book was a murder mystery. I was like, I've done with that. And then I wrote the book and I realized that the whole thing is a huge mystery of unraveling memories and this place is.
Oh, fucking hell. I fell backwards into a mystery again.
Yeah. But I think that's intriguing. And most stories obviously have got a degree of mystery. So I kind of, I tried not to let myself be too influenced by other stuff. I've seen Maze Runner. I've never read it. I guess it's a similar thing of waking up and not knowing why you're there, but the actual labyrinths are very different.
Yeah. So my only background with Maze Runner, and this will be a thing for you to Google when we're not, you know, pretending to do a podcast. But years ago, Saturday Night Live, in one of its, like, fake commercial bits that it does, and I don't know if this is a reference that's very meaningful to you, being on the
Saturday
other side.
Saturday Night Live now in the UK.
They do.
They have a version of it.
They do. They do.
I've not watched it.
I'm sure it's fine.
Shudigatwa hosted and made jokes about Doctor Who.
I saw some of the sketches from it.
Yeah. So, like, gosh, this is like 10 years back. So not recent, but totally Googleable because YouTube has all the things. There's a fake commercial that's like a movie trailer fake commercial in a Saturday Night Live episode that is around that same time the Maze Runner movie was coming out. And so it was like, I'm going to riff on the Maze Runner, but also all of the other sort of, like, super high stakes YA trilogy fantasy things that are going on right now. And so not only have I not read Maze Runner or seen the film, my only Maze Runner knowledge is from a parody of a movie preview of The Maze Runner, which is, I think, in the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon universe of trying to explain my relationship to Maze Runner, is, like, pretty lame. Yeah, it's not really there. Don't really have it. But it is brilliantly funny, and I highly recommend.
I'll have to watch that. Does it have, like, the, I'm guessing it's The Hunger Games as well.
Oh yeah, like all of the bits and pieces of, yeah, you know, it's got a Hunger Games winking, it's got a little Divergent wink in there too. I don't think it does anything with, like, this is like past the having crested the Twilight stuff, so I don't think it does anything with that. But yeah, all that.
I will throw it out there just as a squirrel, since you're talking about SNL.
Mm.
Scarlett Johansson was on SNL. Mm-hmm. And when one of the Avengers movies was coming out or something like that. And so she was in her Black Widow phase of doing stuff. And they did a little fake trailer for like a Black Widow TV show where they stripped it down to, you know, she's in her Black Widow costume, but she's got like a pink cardigan sweater.
Okay. On.
And it's all about, you know, how she's trying to adjust to life in a new city and a new job and trying to find love. And it's very lighthearted. And it's like your typical kind of tropey show, right, where they strip out anything of substance and they just make it like about – like a CW show, like about relationships, mm-hmm, and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very funny at the time. And then I want to say – and our patron Robert can correct me on this. Within like a year of that, give or take, they launched the Supergirl show on CBS. And it was literally that trailer. Like, it was all the tropes and everything that they put into that Black Widow, mm-hmm, fake trailer show was, oh no, what they were doing with Supergirl.
Oh, no.
CBS, which eventually went to the CW, but it started on CBS. But yeah, it was literally that.
Wow.
So they are a little prescient.
Yeah, parody becomes reality.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think that one of the, you know, what Piranesi aside for a moment, that there's, you know, there's some parallels here. Like, there's a little bit of Stranger Things vibe with like the kids on bikes, kind of thematic group of kids find each other. We have to rely on each other. We have to trust each other. We have to work together, kind of thing. But that has its own sort of like family of tropes surrounding it. And I imagine that there's a combination of, these are the tropes I love, this is why I dig this kind of stuff and I want to do this. And also some where you're like, this is kind of tired as a consumer of this and as a lover of these ideas, I'm done with this and I don't want to see it anymore. And so I'm kind of curious about your gotta keeps and gotta goes for, like, how do you respond to the tropes that are typically associated with this kind of like tense kids in darkness and have to navigate their way out?
Well, I think my main character, I deliberately wanted him to be not a conventional main character. You see, even in, like, you know, the groups like that, usually the main character is the sort of brain. Boy who like gets with the girl at the end and then, you know, has a little romance with the girl and he's like the brave leader who's like stabbing the monsters in the chest or whatever. And my main character is not like that. His main strength is actually that he's very kind, which is an unusual thing, I think, especially nowadays, to find in a main character. It seems weird to say, but often in fantasy it gets sort of looked down upon a bit as like a bit naive and a bit...
You have to be grim.
Grim. And or you learn that...
The anti-hero.
Yeah. You learn the error of your ways for being kind. Like, I think of like Sansa Stark. I think this is just me being angry about Sansa Stark, where I'm like, no, you can have a main character that's kind and stays kind and still learns lessons and learns, you know. But also it's the thing that draws them all to him. And I think especially when you're a kid, and like, what I remember of, like, if I was in the playground with no one to play with, I didn't remember like the bravest or the loudest people. I remember the one who came over to me and noticed me and like invited me to play. And that was the kind of main character that I wanted to have. He's also a chubby kid, which is unusual to find as like the main hero of a group like that. Usually they're the one that has to be like looked after or bullied, yeah, or something like that.
Comic relief.
Yeah, comic relief. So I wanted to push back against that kind of portrayal, I guess, and just give people a new sort of hero.
Yeah. I think the kindness is important too, because like you, the situation you described of being by yourself on a playground and then the kid who invites you over, that kid's a hero to you in that moment. Like, you're not sure what to do with yourself and they're telling you, you have a place, you can come on over here and be part of this place. And I think, I don't know, and I've been guilty of this in some of my own writing and own thinking sometimes, that heroism has to be defined by like rather grandiose actions. You know, particularly if you've got a character in a sort of like high stakes and grandiose situation, like, I don't know, waking up as an amnesiac in a labyrinth. But the idea that like small things can still matter and aspects of character that are easily overlooked can be the difference maker is really huge. And I love that.
Yeah, that was the kind of what I wanted to do. But it also was interesting. I like challenging myself as a writer, kind of, sometimes. Sometimes I hate myself later for it. But at the time, I was like, it'll be interesting to see how a person like this sort of approaches, like, in the first room, there is a dragon. It's like, how are we going to defeat the dragon? But he's not someone who's ever going to hurt anything. He won't hurt a fly. So it's like, well, how could this character come at that sort of situation from a different angle?
Yeah, yeah. It also has... I don't know if this came into your mind at all, Patrick, but something about character in Labyrinth and making tough choices and not equipped to deal with the situation is also kind of giving old school choose your own adventure kind of vibes here. This feels like the sort of book where if I were Hop and I were making decisions on Hop's behalf, I would keep getting eaten by the gelatinous slime and needing to turn back 12 pages and start again. Which I guess means that it's good that Hop is in your hands and not mine. So apparently I'm terrible.
I don't know. He doesn't have much like self-preservation vibes. He has a companion that's just a talking skull. And the skull is constantly telling him to like watch himself and don't go up and like, let's not talk to the big scary beast. But he does it anyway. So yeah. I don't know. I feel like if it was in Choose Your Own Adventure, Hop would have died about 50 times.
Oh, I mean, it's been... Fair. Yeah. Ooh, flying skull.
No, talking skull.
Flying? No, talking. Just talking. Yeah, okay, not flying. I guess the flying would be too. That'd be too helpful. I could like go up above the walls and peek at things. Yeah.
He carries it in a little, you know, like a baby sling that parents have.
Oh, he's got like a little baby Bjorn.
Yeah.
He can get his running away from monsters done one, not leave a skull buddy behind. I
mean, two spare hands.
As one does. Oh my god, that's amazing. So, all right, this has opened the door for something else that I looked at and I'm like, oh dear, there's no way we're not talking about this. So if we've got Hop with his like baby rucksack carrying around his talking skull buddy, this feels to me like exactly the sort of vision that someone who makes her own costumes for Comic-Cons would do. So, all right, talk to me about your cosplay here, Frances. I want the deets.
Oh, God. What's there to know? God, I've cosplayed... To be honest, I haven't done it much recently because I've been so busy with, like, writing. But I first cosplayed about 20 years ago.
Wow.
So that's how long I've been cosplaying. And it's like, it must be almost 200 outfits by now.
Oh, my word.
Like, it's crazy. It's been going on a long time. But, yeah, it was a... It's still, I actually am making one at the moment, so I've not completely given up.
Could we ask what or whom it will be, or is that a spoiler?
No, it's not a spoiler. It's a bit of an obscure one, although you guys are nerds, obviously, in the name, so you might know. It's a character from a game called Lost Records, Bloom and Rage.
I've heard of the game, but I haven't.
Yeah, I think it's a Don't Nod game, and it's the main character from that. It's kind of a more casual outfit, but it's one of those ones where you're like, that'll be easy, I can do that. And then you look at it and there's like 1,000 details and you're like, oh God, I've been painting a backpack.
What? No, Frances made her life difficult again? How could this be?
I was like, I could tell myself that you can make it just not accurate. And I was like, no, I can't. It must be accurate.
Your honor is on the line.
Yeah. But yeah, I've done a lot over the years. I actually went to Japan. I competed in the World Cosplay Summit for the UK.
Oh, wow.
Which was, yeah.
I've seen a documentary about them. I've actually used that documentary in one of the classes that I teach. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I think I might have seen that same documentary. Yeah, it's really good.
It's a fun one.
So what about a character like what becomes the inspiration? Like do you have a certain kind of character that when you see that you go, oh, I have to do that? Or like what inspires you to do the cosplay?
I I wouldn't ever cosplay a character without actually like watching or playing the game, because sure. There's plenty of characters that I see and I'm like, it looks like my kind of character, but then mm-hmm. I'll actually want to watch or play the thing. One of my examples is actually Attack on Titan, because okay. my friends were doing a group and on paper I looked at them and I was like, ah, there's like a young blonde boy. That's often the kind Armin. Of ones I cosplay. Yeah. And I was like, obviously I'm going to do Armin. Then I watched it and I was like, oh no, I'm much more of an Eren, because Armin is like, he's got everything under control. He's like clever. He's quick. Eren is a complete like failure and a mess, at least in the first season. And I was like, that's my kind of character. I don't do the cool ones.
So did you end up doing that? Did you?
Yeah, I did. It was really fun.
Did you do the whole? Did you do all the gear and everything, or did you just do the clothes?
Just the clothes, because even just having all those belts was like, I literally couldn't pee all day, so I just didn't drink. I don't recommend this to cosplayers. Please do drink, but I was like, I can't. I guess I'm not drinking today. So it was challenging.
You did the full on scout outfit with all.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I went on stage, we did a little like masquerade thing, and I had in my mouth these like blood capsule things. So I like bit down on my hand and then I bit down on the capsules and I looked like I was like biting down. Yeah. And the audience was like, oh.
So Tracy has no idea what we're talking about, but it's funny, and it's just a coincidence, because that is going to be my pick of the week this week. Is that
it's Attack on Titan?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Look at this.
Yeah.
Nice.
But it is interesting that he bites his hand to trigger his change. I didn't like that. There was a scene where like all the other scouts that like felt like they'd failed him all bit their hands. So they all had the bite marks.
Yeah, I watched it when it aired, so that was a long time ago. When was that? Probably, oh my god, don't tell me it was something like 10 years ago or something now. But yeah, it is a great anime.
Yeah.
I have an assignment that my students do sometimes, and not sometimes, it's like with the specific class I'm talking about, they do it like at the beginning of every sort of thing, where they're going to like tell me what kind of a geek they are by choosing something they're super into and just like talk to me about it, just like info dump the hell out of it and explain to me why this gives me meaningful insight into you. And so many of them have written about Attack on Titan over the years. So I have plenty of like, and if the secondhand smoke is a thing, secondhand Attack on Titan is definitely a thing too.
So. There was a point where it was literally everywhere. I remember just walking out on the street and people had like the backpacks on with the
everything.
So
now it's Chainsaw Man. Yeah.
A lot of people keep telling me to watch that, and I haven't watched that yet. So just like with video games and anything else, I'll check it out in 5 years.
Yeah.
Once the
buzz has thoroughly ended.
Once it's all done, and I don't have to.
You're on like the same plan with me and television shows. Yeah.
It's been canceled. We're not doing any more episodes. No.
Yeah. That's more or less how it is.
We had that moment. Because my friend Adam and his wife Michelle, they went on a family vacation, which I don't understand spending time with family. But they when they got back, I knew that they watched Witch Hat Atelier.
Oh, I want to watch that.
And I was like, I sent them a text, like a group text. I'm like, they either need to make those episodes longer or they need to just dump them all, because this once a week bullshit is killing me. I go, I can't wait for the next episode. And Adam replied, you know, that was the season finale, right? The last one. And I'm like, you shut your fucking mouth. That was not. I was like, no, it was. I'm like, no. Oh. So they dropped like 13 episodes, I want to say. And then now there's nothing until season two. Season two is under production. And I'm like, no. How dare they?
Hopefully it actually gets made. A lot of them seem to get dropped, don't they?
Well, I mean, they've done the teaser trailer for production.
Oh, okay, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, like they've already said, yep, we're doing it. And look, here's a new shot that's never been in anything before. So like, we're doing it. And I'm like, okay. But still, come on.
Yeah. I just had the slight sudden memory that like Blue-Eyed Samurai season 2 is supposed to be a thing.
Yeah,
it is. Is it this fall? I don't remember.
I have no idea at this point.
Yeah, it's like timey-wimey. It's been like better than a year, I think.
It's funny because there's all these things like I know I keep picking on Robert, one of our patrons, but he messaged me and he's like, hey, you know, Axanar is dropping a new episode. And I'm like, I am so sick and tired of them just like breadcrumbing that out that I'm just waiting for all of it now. And if you don't know Axanar, Axanar is a Star Trek fan film kind of thing.
Okay.
That got them sued because they were doing better quality than Paramount, and Paramount got pissed.
Wow.
And so they sued them, and that caused this whole big thing. And so now they're still releasing it, but they're releasing it in a little breadcrumby piecemeal thing. And it's driving me crazy. So I'm like, I'm just going to wait for the whole thing to come out before I watch any of it anymore.
Are you a binge watcher of stuff, Francis? Is that your preferred modality?
Yeah, generally. Just, well, some things I watch as they come out because I'm terrified of getting spoiled, like something she can't avoid. Yeah. But in general, I prefer to wait till they're all out and then watch them all. I did that with Pluribus.
Okay.
And a lot of people were saying it was really slow and stuff, but because I watched it all in one go, I was like, no, it was great. I think some shows just work better that way. Maybe some work better with a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of agnostic as far as that goes. Like I'm frequently very, very behind in the zeitgeist of what folks are watching at any given time. And so usually by the time I get around to watching something, it's out in its totality already. And so I can choose to binge it if I want. But I'm actually quite fine with just doing things week by week. Like the whole,
it can be fun for a change.
Yeah. The whole, how dare you anticipation that Patrick is talking about there. Like, I don't know. I sort of miss that. I kind of feel like, I don't know, a show drops in its totality and you'd like gobble it all up in like 2 days or something. And then it's like, well, now it's done.
Yeah, you don't have like the in between like memes or like jokes between the episodes or people discussing it. That's why I watched Severance as it came out, because there was so much like talking about what was going on. So that was a fun part of.
They're trying to make destination TV and streaming. And I think they're missing the point of streaming. Like the reason people liked Netflix and flocked to Netflix was the fact that they could binge stuff and they could do it without commercials. And now every streamer wants to put commercials in because they're just trying to grab as much profit and money as they can. And they're also like, well, you know, we want the water cooler thing. We want the anticipation thing. So we're going to put an episode out every week. And then those shows don't do as well. And so then they add on the commercials to them. And then they add on all this other stuff trying to make it profitable again. It's like they're completely missing the point of what streaming is and why people go to it. Like that's what the traditional networks were for.
And that's why people get that.
Those kinds of things. And but I mean, it did work when Hulu, as an example, here in the States, shows ABC shows. So, but they don't show them until after they've aired.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It'll like, let's say The Rookie shows up on Tuesday night and then it doesn't show up that same episode on Hulu until the Wednesday after. I think that's fine because it's still linear TV. And it's still doing that. But like if it was something that they specifically made for streaming, then they should just drop it because that's why people use streaming.
Yeah, I guess the problem that like people choosing to do a binge has is like it's completely changed that water cooler thing that you talked about, right? In that because it's possible to binge all of it in one go, I think more and more people assume that that's what everyone's doing. And so when a new thing comes out that I'm interested in seeing, but I know I'm not going to be able to see it in the immediate future, I always have to kind of banish myself from the internet for a period of time or like really, really super carefully curate what I'm interacting with and where I'm going, because everybody who has done the binge feels that they have permission to talk about whatever they want to talk about as freely as they like. And I don't particularly like spoilers. I want to be able to have my own kind of experience. And so what tends to happen for me is even if something drops all in a go, I usually just watch like 2 episodes of it at a time, like a little bit more than 1 episode at a time, because I still want to be able to, whoever I'm watching it with, talk to them and like theorize about what's going to happen next or unpack what people are doing. So I kind of manufacture my own miniaturized water cooler culture around it because I can't have that. I can't just like do shows out there in the universe anymore without other people being like, well, I assume everyone else canceled all their plans for this weekend and just watched 15 hours of Stranger Things or whatever. So let's talk about all of it. And I'll be like, fuck you. Can we not?
Well, I mean, our culture is now at the point where like Supergirl comes out at the theater, right?
Yeah.
And the next day there are channels on YouTube who are talking about, you know, let's break down Supergirl. Let's talk about the ending of Supergirl. Let's you know, what does this mean for the new DCU? What does it mean for this? What does it mean for that?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
that is where we're at now.
You know what? You know where we're not getting that though? I never see that with books. And I kind of love that for books.
We're not dropping like 6 books in one go.
Well, I mean, both the dropping of 6 books in one go. Although we did have a guest on a few months ago, Tao Lei, who was signed to with some books that he'd written. And like we had him on, gosh, I want to say like 3 months ago to talk about his progression fantasy, something like that. And I just got a message saying that the second book is coming out in like a couple weeks. And do we want to have him on for that? And then like the third book is coming out in November. And like the last book is coming out in like February. And I get it. Like that, yeah, it's probably all indie. Been written.
Yeah. That's like indie. Yeah. That's the right. Indie authors who stay.
I have seen
in them. They have to stay in the.
Yeah. It's more of a case of indie, but I have seen some traditional publishers, especially with certain series, try and accelerate the release. Like they used to do one a year for a series. I've seen like one every 6 months they start
right,
to do.
Yeah.
Especially with like something like Romantasy, where they want to get the hype and keep the hype and release it. And,
but I guess what I also mean is like the reader experiences of it is like if the book drops on a Tuesday, there aren't people who are like, and now on Wednesday, we expect everyone to be able to fully engage in the discourse. I mean, sure, there will be people who are going to binge that thing overnight and God bless them. But like, I think there's a more of an understanding that pacing exists is a choice.
It's also it takes longer.
Yeah, to say that. Book. Yeah.
So unless unless you got an arc, you're not doing
it. Yeah. Well, we can all be grateful for the fact that some little corner of the universe doesn't necessarily have to go immediately to spoilers. So maybe we can improve upon the universe of spoilers with things that we do like Picks of the Week.
We'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look. They say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes, like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more, so... That $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and... popular so far. I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people are enjoying it. But our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us and we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, I sense, I don't know why, but I sense that your pick might be Attack on Titan.
It is. And the reason being, like, I'm on this Crunchyroll journey that my friends got me started on. And what's funny is Attack on Titan was not on any of the suggestion lists from people, from my friends. They've all been suggesting other things. However, Crunchyroll and Netflix keep telling me to watch Attack on Titan. And to Francis's point, I remember like there was a lot of buzz around it at the time. And typically what happens is when there's a lot of buzz around something, I get muley and refuse to watch it or pay attention to it. And so I was finally like, okay, I'm going to check this out. And I started watching it. And my first impression was, this is depressing and creepy. And then I just went to, well, this is fucked up. Like,
these are all reasonable impressions.
Yeah. Like, this is fucked up. And the thing that kind of got me is I did watch Black Clover because a friend of mine is really into Black Clover. And Black Clover annoyed me because Asta is a pain in the ass and he's constantly screaming. And he's just doing all this weird shit all the time. But eventually, like when they get to – when he and his like stepbrother get to the capital and things settle down and they start introducing all these other characters and you start getting all like this broader story, it gets to be, in my opinion, a much better show. And so I was like, well, I'm going to give Attack on Titan a little bit of that. And then it's kind of similar. Like once they join the scouts, you know, the three kids and they become these things and they move on and the world gets broader, it gets to be a better show. It is still ridiculously dark, in my opinion. Like, it does not have those moments of lightness and levity and humor that you get from Black Clover. Mm-hmm. But it's still, like, really, really good. And I like the way the story is constructed. And I am probably halfway through it because there's a lot of episodes to it. Which is the other thing that it reminds me of Black Clover. Like, there's just a million episodes on the thing. But what triggered a memory for me is when Francis was talking about, like, the kid that walks up to you in the yard and says, hey, you know, and kind of becomes friends. That happens with Aaron and Armin in Attack on Titan because they do a lot of flashbacks to when they were kids. And Armin got picked on quite a bit. And there's like a moment where Aaron goes, why don't you just fight back? Like he just walks up to him. Why don't you ever fight back? Why don't you ever do anything? And he's like, well, I'm winning because I'm not running away from them. And Aaron's like, huh, I'm Aaron. What's your name? And like, that's when they become friends. And so there was like that moment. But yeah, it's a good show. It's fucked up. But yeah, I suggest people check it out.
Very good. So, Francis, how about you?
So, my week has been very much not that. I've been editing my next book, basically. So, I have been in what I call my gremlin hole.
Oh, okay.
So, there hasn't been much experience of the week, but there is one thing that I've been doing obsessively when I need to turn my brain off away from that book is I've been playing a game called 2 Point Museum on.
Okay.
The Switch. Did anyone ever play Theme Hospital back in the day where you had to like manage a hospital? You build
I did not know.
So, oh my god, it's like an iconic game. It used to be on like just the normal PC, and it's the sort of the same sort of thing, but you're managing like loads of different museums. Mm-hmm. So you're like, there's one that's like a dinosaur one, there's one that's a space one, there's a science one, and there's like an aquarium, and it's really addictive and really fun. You have to like go on expeditions to find items to put in your museum, put them in the right places and manage staff. I love like management games. I don't know why I find it. So I just want, I like games where I'm just doing a normal job in the game.
The non-whimsical Animal Crossing.
Yeah. I mean, I also play very whimsical games like Final Fantasy or Kingdom Hearts, but when I really just want to turn my brain off, stuff like that helps for some reason. The stress of having to manage an entire museum.
There's a guy that I like on he's on the Glass Cannon podcast. His name is Skid Marr. And Skid is originally from Denver, but now he lives in New York. But one of the games that he talks about is there's a game that he likes to play where he's the manager of a video rental store.
Yeah, I know that one. I think I know them all.
Yeah.
That's a really good game.
And he talks about how addictive it is and how you really get into it.
You're just like there scanning like the videos that people are taking out. You're like, I'm literally doing this for fun. I get a job that people would do for a living. I don't know why there's something really cozy about it. I don't know if it's like the monotony.
Especially because like there aren't really video stores around very many places anymore, and so it feels sort of a bit of a throwback.
Well, yeah, not nostalgic.
To throw back to our episode last week, Tracy, we didn't get to talk about this, but there is a resurgence of rental stores coming back for physical media.
I haven't seen that. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's not huge yet, but there are stores like that now that are kind of coming back and renting things again.
Huh.
That's interesting, especially with PlayStation saying they're not going to do physical discs anymore.
Yeah,
which makes me really sad. Because I used to rent my games from a store like that because I didn't have much money. I would just like rent it for a week and then go back and rent it again.
Right, yeah. How many times can I re-up this thing?
Yeah.
It drove me crazy because there was a store called Major Video. And I could not get to Major Video on my own because it was too far away. So my friend Tom always – he had a car. He had to drive me there. And we would always rent Tetris. And it was a really cool version of Tetris. And I did not know there were multiple versions of Tetris that were for the Nintendo at the time. And so the one that I ended up buying, because I was like, this is stupid. I should just buy Tetris because I'm renting it all the time. So I buy it. It was a different game. It was like a different version. It did not have the same thing that the one at the rental store had. It was like a different screen. It was different music. It was, it was all completely different. I used to
betrayed. Rent a lot of stuff.
Heartbreaking.
And then Major Video became Blockbuster. And then they
weren't all right. great
after that. But yeah.
And there you go. The story continues.
Continued.
I think there's like one Blockbuster in the United States left somewhere.
There's one, I think, left. They had the last
Blockbuster. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Yep.
All right. So referencing last week's episode again, I mentioned for that episode that we had had some people over for Big Splody Time Day, the 4th of July. And on Big Splody Time Day, we played some games. And one of them is another game from the Big Potato Games company. This one's called Sounds Fishy. And it operates on a sort of, social dynamic deduction kind of thing. It is a very fun game to play with a crowd of people who are good at kind of thinking on their feet and at bullshit. So you're looking for a group of 4 to 10 players. And in this group, you're going to have two types of cards. There are a set of cards that look like fish. They're like big cardboard cutouts that just legit look like fish. And one side of them is going to be red, all except for one, which is going to be blue. So you distribute a number of fish to people around the table that corresponds to the number of people who are at the table, but you have to make sure one of them is blue. The idea is that you're going to take the other cards that are there, all of which are designed very cleverly, so that there's a question on one side, and then on the opposite side, but down below, so that you can't see it, is the answer to said question. So what the person's going to do, if it is their turn to be the judge of this round, is they take card with the question. They read the question out loud, and then they hold it up to their forehead so that the answer, which they cannot see, is visible to everyone else at the table. And one of the examples that obviously you can't give too many examples of these because then you run out of questions in the deck and it's no good. But one of the examples that they give on the packaging is in what state in the United States is it illegal? In North Dakota, it's illegal to fall asleep in what type of place? Like there are actually laws against falling asleep in this place. And that person puts up the card. And the idea is, everybody at the table has either a red or a blue fish. If you're one of the people with the red fish, your job is, although you have seen what the correct answer is, to lie and tell them something else. If you are the one single solitary blue fish, the true blue fish, rather than giving a red herring, you will just read the answer that's on the card. And so everyone's going to go around and give the answer, and you have to choose who you're going to believe. And hopefully you will choose the person who's not lying to you. The problem is all of these questions and answers are fucking weird. And so you can't just go off of what seems reasonable. Because this question in North Dakota, it's illegal to fall asleep in what place? If I was holding this card up and everyone were able to read the answer, you would know that the real answer is, do you want to guess?
A church.
Nope.
A library.
Nope.
A bar.
Nope.
Movie theater.
Nope.
Restaurant.
Nope.
Diner.
Nope.
Gin joint.
Cheese factory.
Oh.
You'll be put in jail if you fall asleep in a cheese factory. There's got to be a story here that accounts for why this law came into being, but whatever.
Is it because cheese gives you bad dreams? So if you fall asleep.
The Freddy Krueger of cheese will come and get you. Who knows, man?
And so
you kind of need to give a crackpot sounding answer because the correct answer is going to be kind of effed up. And so everybody's just claiming ridiculous sounding crap, and you have to pick the correct ridiculous sounding crap. Points are given, et cetera, et cetera. But honestly, who even cares about points with games like these? So sounds fishy, super easy to teach. Any dingus can do it. And no, you don't have to have particular familiarity with the laws of the United States in order to play the game because who would have guessed the cheese anyway?
I actually played that with my family at Christmas.
Oh, there you go.
Because I saw it online. I thought it looked really good. I bought it for my sister, but my mum was just a terrible liar. Sorry, mum, if she's listening to this. She was like looking, like so often she'd get the right one. She'd be like looking at the person's forehead and they're like, is this a double bluff? Like, no, she just, she can't read very well. She's
yeah.
Like,
Go get your progressives, mum. You need to be able to see the thing on the thing. All right. Well, it's been a ball talking to you, Francis. Congratulations on the Bone Door. Good luck surviving your edits here for Super Secret Book 3 on its way. Where can people find you and your super cool stuff and support the things that you do?
My main platform is Instagram, and it's called Francis White Author, my profile. But I've also got a website that's francis-writes, as in rights, not white. Yeah. .com, so you can have a look there, and it has lots of information about my books and all the socials and everything.
Fantastic. It has been awesome having you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY.social. I know I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake. Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.